Welcome to the latest episode of Actual People. This will be the first episode that contains an interview, and it's not just me doing a monologue. That is a milestone for this podcast. I'm super excited because my first interview is with Anna Holmes, who I knew 30 years ago. She and I were in a writer's group when we first moved to New York that took place in a friend's living room. That friend was Jessica Goldberg, who went on to be a successful playwright, screenwriter, and television writer. Anna Holmes became the founder of feminist online publication Jezebel, owned by Gawker, which shuttered at the end of 2023 and was immediately resurrected by Paste magazine. The internet describes Jezebel as a site millennials turn to for their dose of political commentary, but it was actually created by someone my age, not a millennial, a Gen Xer. I wanted to talk to Anna about the state of creative industries. We ended up leaning into writing careers, her ability to largely stay off social media for a decade, and finding ways to defy definition in a culture where everyone wants to pigeonhole your work. Our conversation started with a little bit of laughter about the sheer number of years that had gone by.
Since I haven't spoken to you in 30 years, maybe?
Yeah, probably.
We were in a writer's group together when we were 19 years old.
Yeah, we were really young.
We were really young, and I was new to New York. You can like tell
me.
You too.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Miami. But then I went to Bennington College, and then I transferred out of Bennington.
Okay.
Yes. I didn't pursue writing and publishing as a career because I got a couple of kill fees. I wrote an article for the Post once, made like $400. And I was like, I can't do this. I can't sustain this.
No, it's not sustainable.
And then I went into consumer insights and brand strategy. But I've been writing this whole time. I have a finished novel. I have a half-finished novel. I have multiple pieces. I write every day. It's always been the money versus the writing.
I've had multiple jobs as an editor at different publications because I was too afraid to try and make a living off of writing alone. I would have staff jobs, and it's not that I disliked them, but I was avoiding doing something that was emotionally, intellectually scary, but also financially scary, you know, because I don't always like writing. I get really insecure about it. Right now, I'm really insecure because I haven't heard from this editor that I'm supposed to hear from about something that I wrote for her that I feel very vulnerable about,
Is it very personal?
Yeah. And she was supposed to get back to me yesterday and she hasn't. And I emailed her yesterday. I said, hey, I'm around this afternoon if you want to talk, and like nothing, haven't heard anything. And I'm like, she's going to fucking kill the piece. And my friend Rebecca is like, stop catastrophizing, but I'm going to be really upset if the piece gets
killed. If she kills the piece, and obviously her not responding has nothing to do with killing the piece, because you know how people get busy or whatever, you know, there's like 10.
I know. But like,
she kills the piece, you can put it somewhere else or make that part of a book. Or maybe there's a reason if it does get killed that it's supposed to be somewhere else.
Maybe.
Reassurance aside, it's just so weird. Yeah. The walls that we build to not do the thing where you're the most vulnerable and you care the most, your actual self is at risk.
Yeah. That's the way I feel with the fact that I haven't heard from her, that my actual self is at risk. And it is a personal story. Maybe I could place it elsewhere, but I don't want to. I also had too much coffee today, but you caught me in a moment where I'm in a state of high anxiety. It's also one of those moments where I feel like I'm waiting for a number of people to get back to me on things, not just professionally, but personally. Like, why isn't my certain friend has responded to me about this one text message I sent? I'm feeling ignored.
I'm doing this podcast. I'm like, if no one listens to it, that's very bad. But if I don't do it, that's also very bad. And this is something I really should do. And so if it doesn't work, where does that leave me as a person? Where if you're doing something that you care about, but isn't like you.
I think the part of finishing writing stuff is, for me, is the fear of not finishing it. But also when you have an editor who assigns you something and you're accountable to them, you know, you have to turn shit in. It's not like I'm so disciplined. I can be disciplined in some cases, but a lot of it is fear of disappointing somebody else. If I had to write something for myself and myself alone, that would be much more difficult than if I have agreed or pitched something to an editor who's then accepted it, you know?
Yeah, but you're legitimized. They've legitimized you also. They want to hear from you. They know what you're capable of. So
there still remains an imposter syndrome aspect.
Wow, really? It never ends.
Never ends. And maybe that's just with certain things. There's certain things where I'm like, that was good. I did that. I don't feel insecure about it. For example, Jezebel, I don't have an imposter thing about that. But there are times I've written things where I'm like, did I phone that one in? You know, or why am I more qualified than somebody else to write about a particular subject?
I never used to think I had imposter syndrome, but I absolutely do.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's static or it's always there. Also, sometimes with me, depends on the day. But there are plenty of people who are writers who don't have big, quote unquote, bylines, who are very good writers, right? As someone who's also read people's writing, their raw copy as an editor, I'm under no impression that people who are published are necessarily better writers than people who are not published. It might be that they know the right people. It might be, you know, maybe they're
of
tapping
course.
Zeitgeist, but I don't think that the talent always rises to the top. And I've seen, you know, the raw copy of writers who are fairly well known, and it's not good. It's not horrible, but you're like, oh, I get it.
I had an editor. I'm like, God, if someone could just, when I did the first episode of this podcast, I had an audio engineer. He was producing me. I was like, okay, I've taken this 98%, but can you make it a little better? He was like, nope, listen to it. He kept making me listen to it and change it and make a decision. He's like, you make the decision. This is your baby. And he kept pushing me. It had to be what I decided to do. He just kept giving me tough love and also being like, I'm like, look, lady, I don't know what. You know, he was kind of a stranger. He's like, I can't read your mind. I know you know what you want. I would love to be able to, I want to hand something off at like 90% and let them coach me into the finish line. But when you're writing fiction, no one's going to do that for you if you're an unknown person. Or I don't even know if people are going to do that for you unless you're like the top 2% revenue producing writers. You know,
I think it's easy. I'm in this weird state where I sold a book, I got an advance, I'm living off the advance, but the advance is not enough for me to live on for 2 years. So then I take on other work, but the taking on of other work gets in the way of me doing the book. It's like this vicious circle. And I won't get paid again for the book until I turn it in, right?
Take away this, that, and the other, it ends up being a very little money, these advances. A six-figure advance ends up being like $20,000. They don't give it to you all at once. Or
No, they divvy it out in quarters. So you get a quarter of it, and then you take away half of that for taxes, basically,
right?
And 15% of that for an agent. And then you're supposed to live off of that leftover money for however long, might be a year, might be two.
What year did you start Jezebel?
2007. So a long time ago.
2007, I moved to Paris in January, right. 2007. I did read Jezebel. When I came home, I read it a lot. I went to Europe for 5 years. When I came back, I felt like everything had changed. Mm-hmm. And Jezebel was one of my connections to culture in New York again.
Yeah. And the world did change in that 5 years. Like Obama got elected. And there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that was happening. Although I think in the moment that it was happening, I wasn't far enough away from it to recognize that there was this big shift happening. I was too heads down trying to run that site on a daily basis. I didn't have a bigger picture.
How did you start it?
I was hired by the company to start a women's website. And I decided what sort of women's website I wanted it to be. So I wasn't hired to make that one, but I was given a certain amount of freedom. And I also kind of hid from the bosses what we were going to be doing in terms of talking about gender politics. I was not explicit with them about the fact that we were going to do that because I knew that they would not like that. So we just
as opposed to being like fashion and relationships,
yeah,
or whatever.
I think they wanted it to be snarky, but I don't think they wanted us to talk about race or gender politics. And we did quite a bit. And by the time they caught on to what we were doing, that was what the site was known for. So, yeah, I don't know if subversive is the right word. It was just a little bit sneaky on our part.
That's amazing that you got. Sometimes that's what you have to do
with men.
With men and being a woman is like you have to slip in your own point of view and intelligence.
Yeah. So yeah, so in 2007, and then I left a little over 3 years later.
Why did you leave it?
I was burnt out, and because it was ruining my marriage.
Okay.
It just all I did was work. all I did was work. I mean, I don't regret it. I don't.
No, you, why would you? Yeah, no.
That's not regret it. It was really bad for my relationship, but I still don't regret it.
What did you do after that?
I was freelancing, writing for different publications. I wrote for The Times. I wrote for The Washington Post. I worked on a book that was branded to Jezebel.
I saw that.
Yeah. So that was mostly what I focused on. It came out in 2013. So it came out 3 years after I left. And it could have come out before then, but I was kind of slow walking it. I wasn't focusing on it and it alone. I was doing other things. So it felt like it went a little bit more slowly than it could have. But it came out in 2013. I hadn't run the site for 3 years by the time the book came out.
I just looked at it right now.
I mean, I haven't like read it with any regularity since I left. I mean, it's been that long. Because, well, if it...
Wait. Tell me the year again. Because then I'm going to tell
you. I left?
Yeah.
2010.
So I came back to the States at the tail end of 2011. I got upset about Jezebel because there was a thread. I was trying to get pregnant. I have twin daughters. They're 10. I had them when I was 40. They were born at the very end of 2013. And there was this article that was the choice to not be a mother. But in the comments, it was really bashing people who did choose to have children. And I got really upset in the comments. And then I was like, I'm not reading Jezebel. I got really mad. I felt like anything that smacked of any kind of traditional female role was kind of maligned. I really liked Jezebel and I feel betrayed somehow. Yeah. Because I felt like someone was like, but it was just the comment section. It wasn't the article itself.
But people sometimes conflated the comments with the site. I mean, they just did. I mean, that you're not the only... People would ascribe things to the writers of the site that were really happening in the comments. It was very hard to divorce those two things from one another. That was really annoying as someone who ran the site and worked on the site, that we were sometimes... There wasn't a distinction made between what we were writing and publishing and what the commenters were saying. But like, you know, it was like...
But that has more to do with the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
You know, and also, what I mean? And that's why I started to feel a little bit like feminism is splintering, or way people feel what feminism is for them. Mm-hmm. So I didn't always agree. I guess that's how it always is, right?
Yeah. I didn't always agree with stuff that the writers who were underneath me when I ran the site said. If they were being overly insulting, I would usually pull them back. But they expressed a lot of opinions on things that I didn't agree with. But that was part of, I thought,
getting people to have a conversation.
Site, you know, because not women are not monolithic in their thinking. Commenters were a major pain in the ass to me a lot of the time, because they could be very judgmental and mean. Not just to each other, but to the staffers.
Yeah.
So I had a real love-hate relationship with them because they were also very loyal and vociferous. We were lucky that we had such a devoted readership, but my God, sometimes...
That's just part of a larger phenomenon of the divisiveness and the kind of unilateral thinking that does not allow for gray areas or any kind of subtlety.
Yeah, which is why I don't engage in social media that much, because it's very easy to reduce people to caricatures. Social media is destructive because, well, it's addictive. It can be very fun, but it rewards reducing people and things, because that's the easiest way for us to wrap our minds around defining what and who someone or something is. There have been plenty of studies about social media rewarding expressions of emotion and rage and anger. The algorithms are engineered to do that.
It perpetuates confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it turns the world upside down, or that the world is hard to grasp onto because of the fact that social media turns the world upside down and you know, rewards caricatures. Also, everyone has an opinion on social media, and I honestly don't care about 95% of them. But social media doesn't reward being contemplative and nuanced. It rewards an expression of opinion and a lot of times negativity or the tearing down of somebody else. I think if you didn't engage with social media, you would have a different relationship to the culture and a different relationship to the world. And maybe it would be a more ignorant one. Maybe I'm coming at it from a place of ignorance because I've pulled away from social media. There are plenty of things like memes or people or influencers or what have you that are well known to everybody, it seems, but me, because I don't engage in social media. But I grew tired of it. I just grew tired of it being an opinion machine.
And it might not even be people's opinions. It might just be their mood that minute.
Yeah, or the demonstration of identity, constantly performing identity, whether that's in things they say or the pictures they post on Instagram of the vacation they went on, stuff that is oftentimes not very curious about the world around us, but is very narcissistic and self-directed. Here's what I think. Here's what I did. Twitter, for example, used to feel more open and engaging than it then became because you could fuck up on Twitter. You could ask questions of things, and there was a spirit of camaraderie and curiosity that then kind of gave way to, well, that's the wrong opinion. You know, how dare you have the wrong opinion? And then kind of pile-ons and stuff like that. And it's when that stuff started happening that I started disengaging with Twitter. That was 10 years ago in 2014. I hate to be that old person who's like, it's social media, but a lot of it is.
Yeah. And as a writer, it's always nipping at your heels. You're very concerned with whatever you put out there.
Yeah. All writers self-edit to a certain degree, but because of the internet, there's the added fear of what if I say the wrong thing? There's not a lot of good faith given to people when they quote unquote fuck up, or maybe they didn't fuck up. And maybe you think the writer fucked up, but the writer's like, no, that's exactly what I wanted to say. And that's exactly what I mean. I definitely have seen this with writers and journalists where they've self-edit more than they did 15 years ago because of always anticipating what an argument might be against what they're saying. And it's good to interrogate your own ideas and opinions and make them clearer and sharper, but there's a point at which you become paralyzed from expressing an opinion because someone might disagree with you, you know?
Or hear the wrong way. And it's sterilizing. It makes life so sterile. It's like a lot of things. I am nervous about what I'm doing because I am putting stuff out there. I am open to ideas, but I have an opinion or a thought. I honestly don't want to offend anybody, but...
But people are easily offended. People love to be offended. People are easily offended. Now I really sound like an old fogey, but I have very little patience for example, I have this column that I'm doing for Bloomberg, a work advice column. And there's one coming out tomorrow, and it's answering the question, the reader's question is, should she disclose her struggles with mental illness to her coworkers, right? And I said no. And then I explained why I said no. And I am absolutely sure that I will get yelled at by two factions of people, people who disagree with the fact that I said no, that she should say no. And then people who are going to be upset about the way I talk about mental illness in the piece. There are going to be people who think I didn't talk about it correctly or I didn't use the right terminology.
You stigmatized it somehow.
Right. And, oh yeah, or by telling her not to disclose that I'm stigmatizing it. And even though I interrogate my own use of language around how I talk about it in the piece, even though I interviewed someone from the American Psychiatric Association who talked to me about best practices around language and how to talk about mental illness. And even though I reveal my own struggles with depression and anxiety, none of that's going to matter. Someone's going to see that I said, no, don't disclose your mental illness, and they're going to lose their mind. And I'm going to get a bunch of reader emails.
What does your editor say?
I actually didn't talk to her about it because someone's going to get mad about everything. This kind of goes to the territory, but there are certain columns that I will write that are going to elicit stronger reactions.
If you have one opinion, you're not going to have the other opinion. You're going to have to take some stand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially as an advice columnist, I have to take a stand. The column I'm working on right now, as in this morning, the question is about should the person talk about politics at work, especially during an election year? And my answer is the same. It's like, no. And it's more nuanced of an answer than that, because I have to write an answer that's at least, you know, 800 to 1,000 words long.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there'll be people who read that and be like, you should speak your mind when you believe something's wrong. And in a perfect world, I would agree. But I don't think we live in that perfect world. And I don't know that talking about politics at work is going to add anything to one's work experience, especially around polarizing subjects. I think that you can listen to what other people have to say about politics, but I don't know that you should chime in. My friend Amy has a saying, and I don't know that she made it up. I don't know that it's her saying, do less, speak less. There's something to be said for not always having to express your opinion like you do on social media. Just listen to people and let that be your experience of them without having to be, well, but I think it's hard to do that because we are socialized to communicate with one another, to have a back and forth. So do less, say less. Is hard for some of us, including me. It provides an interesting challenge. So I mentioned the do less, say less in the piece.
People are disclosing so much of themselves, like you said, performing personality or performing identity. Mm-hmm. It's exhausting. They're just trying to meet the deadline or whatever it is they're doing for.
Well, but also they can use it against you. You could tell a colleague that you suffer from a mental illness, and that is your truth. And it doesn't make you a worse worker or employee or colleague. But if someone has nefarious motives and wants to try and undermine you around that disclosure, then they can. So that's part of the reason why I say in that column not to do it, because I don't necessarily think you should trust your coworkers. Not that you should be paranoid, but like, you know,
they can weaponize it.
They can weaponize it. And it's a different kind of weaponizing than if you were to say you have a heart disease, even though it shouldn't be. Even though mental illness is a illness that should be taken as seriously and not be judged in the same way you wouldn't judge a diagnosis of leukemia or something else, that's just not the way the world works right now. So, but yeah, weaponized is the right way of putting it. It's like, on the one hand, the internet has provided people with certain identities to find community in a way that they couldn't 20 years ago, you know? I think people feel less alone because of their ability to find community on the internet.
I don't know, though. Obviously, they feel very alone.
Still feel alone, but if there's a community of gamers or a community of people who are polyamorous, or, like, you can find like-minded people. That doesn't mean...
Sometimes more bad than good, though.
Maybe. I mean, I feel lucky that you and I grew up in an era where the internet didn't exist, so that we know that there was a different way of living. I kind of feel bad for younger people who don't know anything, but and I'm also fascinated by them. I'm also fascinated by people who don't know anything, but my friend Michael, who was visiting, the one who just left, he was talking about his godson and how his godson has known nothing but a world in which he can watch whatever he wants to watch whenever he wants to watch it. Whereas when we were young, there were television shows and they came on at a certain time on a certain channel and everyone watched them collectively in the country. Like, everyone watched The Cosby Show at 8 o'clock on whatever it was, Thursdays. And so there was a feeling of community. It's a hard reality to communicate to people who are younger because they can't imagine that. The other day we were talking about, I had forgotten about this. There used to be a phone number you could call, maybe it still exists, that would tell you the time.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell you what the time was. And maybe it still exists. But yeah, I'm glad that our generation straddles the kind of old and the new, because
we have like more cohesion and community in our local, in our household, in our small environment. And now people can connect from far away, but they're not really connected in a physical way. Right. And they miss all the nuance. And
yeah, I do miss the nuance.
So as we've spoken about at length, you do try to stay away from social media, but you do have a very good handle on what is going on. Do you consider yourself a journalist?
Sometimes. I think I commit acts of journalism sometimes. But I don't know if I consider myself a journalist. Because I, yeah.
But you write about culture. Most of the pieces.
Yeah. But
you are a cultural observer for a living on some level.
If someone said, what do? I'd say I'm a writer. And then they would probably ask, well, what sort of writing do? And then I might get specific. I purposely avoided getting pigeonholed because of Jezebel. Like, there was a world in which I could have like leaned into, I'm just going to talk about gender politics.
I'm a feminist.
And I'm going to market myself as X, Y, or Z, is this certain thing. And I'm going to, you know, do speeches and I'm going to only focus on gender politics and everything I do and say. And that would have been my brand. And I didn't do that.
So tell me about that choice. What led you to become a writer?
I don't know why I chose to be a writer or a journalist, because there were other things that interested me when I was younger. I'm not the person who's like, I knew I was meant to be this and I knew that from a young age and I did it. I liked reading and I liked reading powerful writing and I wished I could have that sort of effect on people. But honestly, I kind of feel sometimes like, I'm like, what? I'm 50 and I'm a writer? I could have been so many other things. I don't regret being a writer. It didn't feel like it was inevitable. It felt like, you know, it just didn't feel like it was inevitable. And again, I don't question my choice, but I don't think that my identity is that of a writer.
What do you like to read?
It's hard. It's a hard question to answer because I'm working on this book. And so everything I read has to do with stuff for the book.
What's the book about?
And it's about the ways in which women communicate, but that's all. That's
it's about the way women communicate?
Yeah. I'm someone who doesn't want to jinx my idea. I don't like talking about my idea in advance because I feel superstitious. There's 30 books stacked up on my floor and they're all books I've looked at. And most of them are for the book that I'm writing. I haven't looked at books for pleasure in some time. Maybe over the summer I was reading like a novel. What was I reading? Maybe Jane Eyre. But other than that, there's a level of guilt that I would have if I was reading for pleasure, which is a ridiculous thing to say.
No, but that makes sense. Now you're working on a project. All of your mental energy has to go to that.
All of it should and all of it doesn't. And so there's already guilt around the fact that a lot of my mental energy doesn't go towards the book. I would see reading for pleasure as procrastinating and avoiding the inevitable, which is that I got to finish this.
The last writing workshop I took, which was in December of last year, not this past December, burnt me out. I couldn't handle writing my various manuscripts anymore. And I stopped writing for 6 months. And I suddenly, out of nowhere, magically started reading fiction again. Mm-hmm. I read more last year, not like a book a week. I'm not sure the number, but it was a nice steady clip. I was reading mm-hmm. and finishing and picking up another book and started really using the library. But when I stopped writing, I could finally read again. Because I would read and be like, oh, I should be writing, not reading.
Yeah. Yeah. People feel guilty for not reading, right? They're like, I should read more books. But then when they do, they feel guilty because they're reading and they're not doing the other thing.
Like somebody else wrote this and they got it published and I'm sitting here reading it mm-hmm. and time's wasting. Mm-hmm. From your lens, what is the state of publishing right now? What are your peers facing or involved with that as a marker of maybe a new time in publishing and media?
They're dealing with the fact that everything is closing and they're losing jobs and they have to do things to supplement their media income. Whereas, 20 years ago, they would have stable publishing jobs with 401ks and benefits working for legacy media companies. Maybe they'd work for those companies for their entirety of their career and then retire. But like, I don't know anyone who fits that bill, unless maybe they work for the New York Times. So they're trying to find new sources of incomes. Maybe they teach a little bit, right? Or they, as writers, write things they don't want to write to make money, or they go into marketing or public relations because that feels more stable and is probably more remunerative than journalism, or they switch careers. I mean, I think that it's a very precarious time. I happen to be lucky enough that I don't feel, it's not that I don't feel there's a precariousness, there is, but I don't think I'm subject to it the same way a lot of other people are, at least not right now, knock on wood.
Because you have a book deal and you're writing a book.
Right. Right. But what happens after that? I don't know.
So do you have any advice for writers?
Maybe I'm just in a pessimistic mood. But part of me would be like, don't look to writing as a full-time job.
Don't
do it. Or do it on the side, Or do it on the side. It feels like every bit of media news that I hear is negative, is like something shutting down or some private equity company buys a publication and then runs it into the ground. It just doesn't feel like there's really any good news.
Yeah,
and I don't,
that's what I was going to talk about originally. Everything's just ending. And so where do things begin again?
Yeah, maybe things will begin again and we'll find a new way forward. But I've never been good at predicting the future with regards to media, ever. And anyone who says that they can is lying.
So there you go. This has been Actual People's first full interview. I have thoroughly enjoyed getting reacquainted with Jezebel founding editor and creator Anna Holmes. Since she's broken free from social media, the best way to get more of her is to stay tuned for her forthcoming book, Still in the Works, which will explore how women communicate with each other. And definitely go and read her Bloomberg Advice column, hilariously named Sad Desk Salad. You've been listening to Actual People. This show is written, directed, and executive produced by me, your host, Chauncey Zalkin. Show sound designed by Eric Aaron. Click on the link below to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And don't forget to leave a review. I'll be sharing my favorites. You can find our socials and all links to deeper dives into these topics at chaunceyzalkin.com and on my Substack at chaunceyzalkin.substack.com. Actual People is available wherever you get your podcasts.